My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or a banking day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 22 in our series for 2023, and today's date is Friday, June the 30th. First, I'll be talking to Jonty Ayoub, founder and CEO of AIMS, who'll talk about how people can protect themselves from online scams. And I'll be talking to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver about the market outlook for the next financial year. But now, let's talk to Jonty Ayoub. Jonty, Australians have lost billions to online scams. How should they protect themselves from these scams?
The point that we really need to stress here is buyers beware is probably going to be the first thing that comes in mind on my end in terms of advice. If something doesn't look right, don't do it. You know, nothing is free in this life. And when we're purchasing online and then we're, you know, put into a different database and we don't know where our data goes and then where our details go. And then we're next minute we're given a Ubute offer or deal, you know, like a free iPhone for paying $2 in the delivery. It just doesn't make sense. So, you know, obviously that's phishing for your information and phishing for your credit card details. And yet you have to only purchase from trusted sites. There are a few methods that help us identify and can help a user identify a trusted site. There's always something that's, you know, quite unknown is at the top, wherever you go to enter in the business's name or the website's name, there's a padlock. So that padlock identifies whether or not it's a secure site or not. If the padlock's open, it's a sign that it's an unsecured site, so it's not verified. When the padlock's closed, it's a sign that the site's been verified. So these are the two things that have been put in place and have had a very strong push recently to secure and prevent the user's data from being compromised.
You'd also have to check whether it's a reputable business too, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. So there you can do that. And let me just stress here, and we preach this at AIMS Group all the time, always read the reviews. Before you purchase, open up a new window. If you're not very tech savvy, go to another device or, you know, your partner's phone. Type in the company's name in Google and read what they're about before you make that purchase. Buyers beware. And it's the same thing. These principles are not new. You know, if you've, you know, I'm not sure where you're located, but, you know, here in Sydney, you know, one of the most popular roads are called, you know, Parramatta Road. Traditionally, if you were driving down Parramatta Road and saw a pop-up store, you'd have a bit of buyer's beware. It's a new brand. You don't know once you give your money if you're going to get the goods delivered. So you do your research. And online is the exact same thing. In life, we're always taught not to believe exactly what we see. And we have to have some level of, you know, due diligence in making sure that you've got the review platforms there. If they've had no reviews, then there's something wrong. If they've had 5 reviews and they're all good, then okay, that will increase your trust signal slightly. The same principles of life should always be applied to the online world as well.
You would surely also have to check the terms and conditions and other details of what they're offering.
Yeah, I think on a thorough level, I personally do, but unfortunately, I think it was nearly 80% of buyers or 82% of online buyers don't read the terms and conditions. They're more interested in knowing price, delivery, how fast something can come. And yeah, to the terms and conditions are one of what we see, one of the less, the smallest red pages on a site pre-purchase. But, you know, yes, terms and conditions are very important. They're obviously governed by common law as well. So, you know, there is a little bit of consumer protection there. But yes, it also has, you know, caused problems previously by buyers. Again, buyers beware. You're always told to read the T's and C's.
But people simply don't do that?
Yeah, we find many buyers don't do that. Many users don't read the terms and conditions. You'd be quite surprised at how large of a number that is.
What about checking the URL of the site?
Yes, very important. So, you know, checking the URL is, as mentioned previously, you know, by looking at the URL, you're able to take the actual business name, and then, you know, do a simple Google search and read up on that company's profile and see if they're, you know, a verified business, a legitimate business. And I have to stress, the URL has a padlock on it. If the padlock's open, then it's not a trusted site. So that business hasn't applied the right principles of security online for their business.
Okay. So, I mean, but the issue too is that, I mean, a lot of people sort of going into this, but they're not exactly tech savvy. So how much of an issue is that?
I'm not going to say it's a great issue. I think the experience of online has come a very long way at helping anyone of any language and of any tech background to make a purchase and view a product online. Scamming is where what we're seeing a massive rise across the whole world. We're seeing a very big rise in hackers and scamming, you know, scam artists, what I call them, playing on the vulnerabilities of people not being tech savvy. So by not being tech savvy, you don't understand when you click a link or when you are asked to click on something that the technology that's being used is there to basically extract all of your personal information. It could be from your bank accounts, it could be your driver's license, it could be, you know, anything that you've kind of left on there, and you don't know how to remove it. So you wouldn't know how to delete whatever they've put in place. So not being tech savvy is kind of detrimental there. But to make a secure online purchase, it shouldn't be a problem. It should be quite simple. And if it's a good business in place, they've put the right user flow there to help anyone of any experience make that essential purchase.
Has that been an issue, the rise in scammers?
Yes, it has. So, you know, phishing and on the most simplest level, data stealing has risen massively, but also credit card information, purchase order history stolen, a lot of different apps, you know, anything that's on that phone of yours is now able to be hacked. If you click the wrong link without that buyer's beware or that scamming beware, your information is more than likely going to end up on the other side of the world.
That's quite extraordinary. And so
it's a scary time, you know, across the world, or even now, you know, a lot of people have bought their parents, their grandparents, these devices, and once curious, once they get the device, they click through, they look, that, you know, they're impressed, they see, and then they begin their online journey. And, you know, very innocently, not knowing that there's a lot of scamming out there, and they're targeting the vulnerable at the moment.
So the key for people now is buyer beware.
I believe so.
Well, Jonty, thank you very much for your time. It's been terrific. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you.
And now let's talk to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver.
Well, Shane, what's your view about what's going to be happening in the markets and the year ahead?
Look, I think we'll probably see a rising trend in share markets, but it will probably have a correction along the way, at least. We have seen good gains from where markets ended the last financial year, back in June last year. Markets are up quite solidly since then, but now they're looking a little bit overbought. We've got ongoing concerns about recession. We would think that recession is a 50% probability or possibility in Australia, so it's a 50-50 proposition at present. And obviously that raises threats to company profits, and it's still unclear that central banks have finished raising interest rates. I think they're close to the top, but by the same token, we could still have a bit more to go. So all of those things could give us a bit of short-term volatility, potential correction through into the September quarter. Albeit I note that July is usually okay, but August, September, October are usually a bit rough. But on a 12-month horizon, I think we will see clear evidence that inflation's coming back under control and central banks will be able to get off the brakes and start cutting interest rates through the next calendar year. So that should help markets on a 12-month horizon, even though the next few months might be a bit rough.
But the problem with inflation is it's quite sticky.
It is, and some countries worse than others. The US inflation rate has come down quite nicely from 9% about a year ago to 4% now. But we are seeing issues in, for example, the UK and maybe in Australia, where we're seeing second round effects which risk perpetuating high inflation. Notably, via strong wage growth. In the UK, wages growth is running at 7%. In Australia, it's still below 4%, but there's lots of telltale signs there, including the Fair Work Commission's decision to increase the minimum wage by 8.6%, that we're going to see stronger wages growth ahead, and that risks perpetuating higher inflation to the extent that companies then have to pass on higher costs. So that's obviously a bit of a risk in the short term. I think ultimately, though, as economies slide into very weak growth, potentially recession, history tells us that that leads to weaker labour markets and lower wages growth and lower inflation. And I think we'll see the same thing this time around, but it may take a little bit longer to get to that point compared to what we might have been hoping for 6 or 12 months ago.
What was worrying was the Bank of England this week sort of increased their rates by 0.50 basis points. That's quite worrying. And that's up to 5%.
That's right. I mean, that's sort of in the band. Don't forget the Fed is over 5% present and still signalling more in the US. The thing about the UK is that their inflation rate is still rising, or that the underlying rate of inflation is still rising. It rose to 7.1% on the so-called core measure. And they've got very strong wages growth impacting as well. Whereas in the US, you can make an argument that wages growth is actually slowing down, so taking pressure off. Whereas in the UK, it's still rising. So that's why we've seen that more aggressive response from the Bank of England. Yeah, there was some talk a few months ago that the Bank of England may be near the top or maybe done. That's now getting reversed. But I think they are a bit of an outlier. Europe is seeing better trend in inflation, lower inflation, more of a downswing occurring, and likewise in the US. But obviously there is a bit of a read through from what's going on in the UK to Australia. It shows what happens if wages growth look like they're getting too strong. Central banks worry that that then will perpetuate high inflation as you end up with a wage price spiral, as we saw in the 1970s. Now, don't get me wrong here. I think everyone wants to see their wages keep up or exceed, or wages growth exceed inflation. But when it's keeping up with inflation at around 7 or 8%, that's not such a good thing. I mean, it just perpetuates that high inflation number. And ultimately, if that happens, it will be a bad thing for everybody, because it will mean permanently much higher interest rates than we've currently got, and probably much higher unemployment to get it back down. So that's why central banks need to guard against that.
What's your prognosis for the Australian inflation? I mean, that seems to be not going down at all.
Well, it has come down. The monthly measure, well, if you look at the quarterly measure, it's come down from 7.8% at the end of last year to 7%. So it has rolled over. The monthly measure, which is a bit more timely, peaks at above 8%, I think at 8.3%. It's currently fallen back to 6.8%. Back in March, it had fallen as low as 6.3%. And there's a good chance that when some new numbers come out this week, we'll see a further leg down in that measure. But it's still too high. Whether it's 6% or 6.8%, it's still too high. And that's why I think you're probably going to see the Reserve Bank maintain a tightening bias. We had thought they were done or pretty close to it. We still think they are pretty close to the top, but it looks like we're going to see probably another two hikes from the RBA. And they've become more hawkish after the Fair Work Commission decision to grant much higher increases in the minimum wage and award wages compared to last year. So they're now a lot more concerned that you're going to go down the UK path, and that's leading to a more hawkish response by the RBA, and largely explains why we've moved to the view that the risk of recession here is now 50%.
So you're saying we're probably going to get rate rises in July and August?
Probably July and August. If we don't get one in July, then I think it will come in August, and then it'll be August, September. I mean, the RBA may decide, well, time for another pause, you know, like the Fed. The Fed has said that there's still more to do on rates to control inflation, but they can move at a more moderate pace, and that means having a pause every so often or skipping a meeting. So they may well do that at next week's meeting if the inflation numbers for May show a bit of a pullback. But I think cutting beyond that, the RBA will still conclude that inflation's too high, that the threats to stronger wages growth, locking in inflation at higher levels, have become high, and therefore they'll maintain this this inclination to hike again. So yes, we are looking for another 2.25% hikes, probably in July, but if not another one in July, then it'll come in August, and the next one will be in September.
Which would take the rates up to what?
Well, we're currently 4.1% with the cash rate. That would take the cash rate up to 4.6%. I mean, if you look at it economically, I think the Reserve Bank's already done enough and is threatening to knock us off the narrow path they refer to into recession. There's a lot of pain coming down the pipeline for consumers. We're now seeing the 40% of homeowners or homeowners with a mortgage had locked into fixed rates. They're now rolling over to much higher rates. If they'd locked in a few years ago at 2%, they're now rolling over to something like 5, 6%, probably around 6%. And that's quite a big blow to household spending power. Obviously, the Reserve Bank's also done analysis showing that something like 15% of those on variable rates this year will move into negative cash flow. That is, their after-tax income will be less than their spending on essential items and servicing their debt, which is a fairly dire situation because it means they have to dip into their savings, or if not, they could run into financial difficulties. Now, of course, that analysis was done on the cash rate rising to 3.75%, and we're now at 4.1%, and it looks like we're going to go higher. So there's probably going to be more people in negative cash flow as this year proceeds than even the Reserve Bank was assuming just a few months ago. So that's where the bulk of the weakness will come from. It will come from the consumer. I know a lot of people say, well, you know, the unemployment rate's only 3.6%. You know, that's near a 50-year low. Share market's up from its lows last year. Economy's still growing. Restaurants are doing pretty well. You know, the roads are full. Lots of people travelling overseas. What's the problem? Well, that's what people were saying in 1989 as well. And then, of course, 1990 came around and we ended up in deep recession. There's always a lag in the way monetary policy impacts. And we are already starting to see cracks emerge with falling real retail sales. Business conditions look to be rolling over. We're seeing a pickup in business insolvencies, as reported in the media today. We're seeing obviously a big collapse in building approvals, approvals to build new homes. Anecdotes from companies are turning far less positive, in fact, quite negative. So I think we are going to see quite a sharp slowdown ahead, if not recession.
With the RBA, I mean, there's going to be a new governor, new administration of the RBA. How do you think they're going to go?
Well, hopefully there's not a new one. I think it makes sense to stick with the current leadership because we are halfway through a war on inflation. And if we change leaders, then the new leader has to re-establish their anti-inflation credentials, which may mean higher interest rates or a delay in getting inflation back down. So I think it makes sense to stick with what we have. That said, the government, you know, there's a lot of talk that there will be a change. The government might be preferring to do that. Some might see this as payback for, you know, the misguidance on interest rates a few years ago, and also, you know, payback for the pain higher interest rates are causing. But that also runs the risk of looking like political interference. But I think providing the new governor has good credentials, and so far the people that have been mentioned in the media, including Michelle Bullock, the current deputy governor, and Stephen Kennedy, the head of Treasury, and also the head of Finance, I mean, providing it someone with good credentials, commitment to the low inflation target, then I think, you know, you could see a bit of uncertainty initially, but ultimately it wouldn't necessarily result in a radically different outcome. It could just result in a bit of period where they may have to raise interest rates more than Lowe would have had to do. But I think bottom line is that as long as the target remains in place at 2-3% and the review indicates or has recommended that, then ultimately it's not going to make a huge difference if they change the leader, except in the short term that it might make it that the new leader will have to establish their anti-inflation credentials.
But in view of the stickiness of inflation, it could take some time before it gets down to 2-3%.
Look, it could. The Reserve Bank is currently saying that it won't get to the top of that range till 2025, but I think that could be changed. If we slide into recession and unemployment starts rising and you've got less people going out to restaurants and spending on hospitality and other areas, then that stickiness will start to abate pretty quickly. And then we'll be talking about, you know, discounting again. And to some degree, you're seeing signs of that in the US. You go back a year or so ago, all of the anecdotes were about how higher price. Now in the US, you're seeing more of a mix. Yeah, sure, some prices are still going up, but you also hear more about lower prices. Even rents in the US look like they're starting to roll over. So what is the case today won't necessarily hang around. If we go into a steeper slowdown in the economy, higher unemployment, potentially recession, today's inflation problem could turn into, could swing back to a low inflation problem in a few years down the track. So a fair way to go on all of that yet. But and I agree that inflation right now is too high and it'll take a while to get it down. But history tells us that if you go into recession or even a steep slowdown, you do see less in the way of inflationary pressure.
Well, Shane, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Leon. And I guess there's been a lot of talk about the Taylor Swift concerts in February. Maybe we're going to need a bit of a lift from Taylor Swift when she comes here to help us shake off the malaise regarding the hit to the economy from higher interest rates.
Dude, well, Shane, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Leon. Take care.
So what's happening in the news? Well, renowned investor Jim...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Rogers, a veteran American big shot who has worked closely with George Soros and co-founded Soros Fund Management, recently made a startling prediction about the future of the financial market. According to Rogers, the next bear market will be the most significant in the last 80 years, drawing parallels with the great financial crisis of 2008, and foreseeing an even worse scenario. Rogers highlighted the mounting levels of debt within the global economic system as a crucial factor that will eventually trigger a severe bear market in risk assets. Pairing the current state of affairs to the 2008 crisis, he emphasised that the debt levels have skyrocketed since then, making the situation far more precarious. Rogers also drew attention to the great inflationary crisis of 1980, recalling the substantial interest rates and treasury yields that were necessary to combat inflation at the time. He warns that a similar situation could be on the horizon for the market. The concerns raised by Rogers extend across multiple markets, including property, stocks, bonds and currencies. During the 1980s, interest rates on treasury bills reached staggering heights of over 21% during the last massive inflationary storm that struck the market. And governments around the world should raise taxes or cut public spending to help central banks tame inflation and mitigate the risk of a financial crisis, the Bank for International Settlements has said. Central Bank's bank, which often operates as an informal mouthpiece for the institution, said governments were testing the boundaries of what might be called the region of stability by leaving fiscal policy loose while inflation remains high and interest rates are rising rapidly. Fiscal consolidation would provide critical support in the inflation fight, the BIS said in its annual report, published on Sunday. It would also reduce the need for monetary policy to keep interest rates higher for longer, thereby reducing the risk of financial instability. Traditionally, there's been a separation between fiscal policy set by governments and monetary policy set by central banks and targeted to control inflation while taking account of the levels of public spending and taxation. Central banks have insisted they are confident in their ability to separate monetary policy decisions from financial stability concerns. But the BIS's concern contrasts with those assurances. Chances of a financial crisis are significant,
given that interest rates are high and still rising, the BIS said. However, it added that this risk could be reduced if governments tightened fiscal policy, taking some pressure off interest rates as a primary policy pool and strengthening countries' public finances. An oil and gas major are stepping up efforts to break into lithium to diversify beyond fossil fuels as hopes rise over a technological breakthrough to produce a metal critical for electric car batteries. ExxonMobil, Schlumberger, Occidental Petroleum and Equinor are exploring whether their core skills of pumping, processing and reinjecting underground fluids, such as oil and water, could be deployed to process lithium from unconventional brines and resources, helping to ease forecast shortages of material expected to be vital for the energy transition. There are a number of oil and gas majors putting a lot of time and attention into how they can become big in lithium, said Brian Minnell, chief executive of TechMet, a mining investment fund backed by the US government. TechMet has a stake in Energy Source Minerals, or ESM, a lithium developer backed by oilfield services giant Schlumberger. The potential push into lithium comes as producers from Exxon and Chevron in the US to Equinor and BP in Europe try to remain profitable amid a global effort to curb emissions and transition from fossil fuels to cleaner energy. Oil majors' drive into lithium would reassure automakers that at present rely on small, unproven miners to deliver the vast quantities of lithium needed to electrify their vehicles in the coming decade as Western countries ban sales of new petrol and diesel cars and as electric vehicle use soars in China. And high interest rates are expected to make the Australian economy one of the worst performed across the Asia-Pacific over the next 2 years, with warnings of full impact of the Reserve Bank's aggressive tightening of monetary policy has yet to be felt. Ratings agency S&P Global has forecast Australia's economy to expand by just 1.4% this calendar year, making it the fifth slowest of the 14 major Asia-Pacific economies tracked by the organisation. Next year, it is tipping growth to slow to 1.2%, dragging Australia down to the second worst economy in the region, ahead of only Japan, which is expected to expand by 1.1%. S&P has sliced half a percentage point from its forecast earlier this year on the Australian economy, due largely to the growing impact of the RBA's sharp increases in interest rates this year. And PricewaterhouseCoopers plans to exit all government advisory work, entering an exclusivity agreement to divest its federal and state government business to Electro Funds for $1 in the wake of the tax leak scam. The $1 price tag means the consulting business has effectively lost all its value. Allegro would meet the cost of setting up and running the new venture if the deal goes ahead. It will have about $300 million in theoretical billings, and it will only provide consulting services to public sector organisations. The Big Four consulting firm on Sunday announced it would aim to sign a binding agreement with Allegro Funds by the end of July. At the same time, it revealed Kevin Burrows would be appointed as Chief Executive Officer. Government work accounted for 20% of BWC's revenue in the 2023 financial year and will impact its future size and operations, the firm said in a statement. Around 130 PwC partners and up to 2,000 employees would move across to the new business known as Project Bell. PwC's inability to deal with its tax leak scandal led to the Department of Finance effectively banning PwC from winning any new contracts from the Commonwealth last month, all but destroying a business previously worth about $250 million in billings a year. The difference in the size of the billings is due to the inclusion of the firm's risk consulting arm in a potential deal. The proposed new company will involve former PwC partners providing government, health, infrastructure, defence and risk advisory consulting services. It will have separate systems and offices from PwC and operate throughout Australia. Bell's interim leadership team is made up 10 PwC partners, Tim Jackson, PwC's Global Government Public Service Advisory Leader, David Sachs, firm's Government Consulting Practice Leader, Jamie Briggs, the firm's Adelaide Management Partner, Ben Neal, the firm's Defence Leader Partner, Chris Rogan, the firm's Markets Managing Partner, Adrian Box, PwC's National Leader for Integrated Infrastructure, Tricia Tebbett, the firm's Perth Consulting Lead Partner, Diane Rutter, Kate Evans and Josh Charmer. And if PwC and Allegro, the 10 partners who will lead Bell, can actually pull it off, it could change the Big Four accounting consulting oligopoly forever. That's because Bell, or whatever the business ends up being called, will give up all private sector work, a move specifically designed to deal with what a Senate report last week described as a conflict at the heart of the PwC scandal. The fact the firm has always worked as a tax agent and advisor for the private sector while also advising the public sector. Bell would specialise in work for government departments and agencies, public sector organisations such as universities and public health bodies. The idea is that by steering clear of the private sector, Bell simply couldn't do what PwC did use secret government information to help corporate clients and then make profits for itself. The new body will also need to adhere to the Australian Public Service Code of Conduct. Notably, none of the 63 PwC partners and staff on the infamous list of people who received the leaked tax information would work for the new company, nor will anyone associated with other government scandals such as Robodebt. The hope is that a pure-play, independent government consulting firm would have a distinct advantage over the likes of Deloitte, KPMG and EY, which would continue to face a challenge of managing the structural conflict that the Senate committee wants addressed. That's not to mention McKinsey and Boston Consulting Group, who have a model where they advise governments on policy and then companies affected by that policy on strategy. Which begs the question, if Bell does get off the ground, and that remains a big if at this stage, could the other members of the Big Four be forced to contemplate a similar split? And Singapore-based PwC veteran Kevin Burrows is a safe pair of hands who has been parachuted into its Australian headquarters to help steer the firm out of the controversy that has erupted its local business and severely embarrassed its global partners. British-born Burrows, a PwC partner for 19 years, is currently PwC's clients and industry's leader, with a strong background in financial services. With PwC's New York-based global chair, Bob Morris, delivering a scathing criticism of his Australian leadership, which he said had failed to meet the network's code of conduct and uphold its professional standards and values, Burrows will have a major role playing restoring trust in the organisation's Australian business. PwC's Australian chair, Justin Carroll, said Burrows' experience across other parts of the accounting firm network would allow him to bring a fresh perspective to the firm. He said Burrows would work with his colleagues and management team to re-earn trust with PwC Australia's stakeholders. In a statement, Burrows said he would work tirelessly to increase transparency and repair trust with our stakeholders, while also enhancing our governance and culture. Burrows took up his current role in Singapore in July 2020 after 4 years as a member of PwC's UK's executive board, where he was managing partner, clients and markets. And some of the world's biggest car companies say Australia must urgently adopt globally competitive fuel efficiency targets if it wants to boost imports of affordable electric vehicles and ensure the carbon-intensive transport sector has its fair share of contributing to legally binding climate targets. In a new submission to the Albanese government, key industry group for electric vehicle manufacturers, retailers, importers and charging station suppliers recommends the introduction of credible and ambitious vehicle pollution limits to reward car makers for bringing more low and zero emissions vehicles into the local market and penalising those who do not. Australia trails globally on the adoption of electric vehicles. Just 3.8% of new vehicles sales were electric last year, compared with 8% in the United States, 23% in Britain and 25% in Europe, the International Energy Agency says. The Albanese government has set a target to cut emissions by 43% by 2030, and net zero by 2050. New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland have set targets for EVs to reach 50% of new car sales by 2030 and 100% by 2035. But without strict pollution limits that match the ambitious goals set by the United States and the European Union, car makers would have to target countries with more attractive policies, the Council says. The US Fuel Efficiency Standard, forecast to cut the country's emissions by 40% by the end of the decade, is designed to boost sales of electric vehicles by 1,000%, so they account for 67% of new passenger car sales sold in the US by 2032. And almost $270 billion of Australian home loans are at risk of defaulting or being classified as severely stressed in the next year, as the borrowers behind zombie mortgages struggle to keep up with their repayments. COVID-19 mortgage boom may come to haunt the major banks, warned Barron Joey banking analyst John Mott, as loans written when interest rates were at record lows become increasingly expensive to service as the employment outlook deteriorates and the cost of living bites. This follows 12 cash rate increases from the Reserve Bank over the past 13 months that have added about $20,000 to annual repayments on a $750,000 loan. As RBA Deputy Governor Michelle Bullock warned, unemployment had to reach 4.5% in the next 18 months to tame persistently high inflation. Mr. Mott said Australia was likely to hit the technical recession, two straight quarters of economic contraction, and the jobless rate could stretch as high as 5% and create a wave of zombie mortgages. New Zealand's economy slipped into recession this month. This will have a significant impact on many mortgagers who borrow their maximum, the bank analyst said. Many of these customers are likely to fall into delinquency as serviceability buffers have been exceeded, real wages have fallen, and additional work is likely to become harder to come by. The Big Four banks wrote $267 billion in home loans over the 2022 financial years to borrowers who took on debt of more than 6 times their income. Analysis by Barry Joey found a debt-to-income ratio of 6 times or more is considered risky by the prudential regulator, and social media giants will be hit with millions of dollars in fines if they repeatedly fail to remove disinformation and misinformation from their platforms under a major crackdown by the Albanese government. Communications Minister Michelle Rowland on Sunday released draft legislation to give the Australian Communications and Media Authority, or ACMA, powers to hold digital platforms to account for spreading the harmful fake news. Under proposed laws, the authority will be able to impose a new code on specific companies that repeatedly fail to combat misinformation and disinformation, or an industry-wide standard to force digital platforms to remove harmful content. The maximum penalty for breaching an industry standard would be $6.88 million, or 5% of a company's global turnover. In the case of Facebook's owner Meta, for example, the maximum penalty could amount to a fine of more than $8 billion. Codes or standards could include requiring platforms to have better tools to identify and report misinformation, a more robust complaint handling process, and greater use of fact checkers. Under proposed laws, the ACMA would also be able to obtain information and documents from digital platforms relating to misinformation and disinformation on their services. But the government says the ACMA would not have a role in determining what is true or false. The draft legislation went out for public consultation from Sunday, which Rowland said would give companies and the public a chance to have their say. And business collapses have hit their highest monthly level in more than 7 years, as failures spread beyond property construction to retail, healthcare, childcare and mining. Higher interest rates, weaker consumer spending and directors throwing in the keys after a temporary pandemic reprieve are the main reason for the jump in insolvencies. Insolvency and restructuring appointments hit 868 last month, the highest monthly result since November 2015, according to analysis of Australian Securities Investment Commission data. While some of the spike is attributed to a catch-up of struggling businesses that delayed folding during the pandemic, insolvency practitioners say momentum is building after a quiet few years. Insolvency work fell to record lows during the pandemic due to massive stimulus payments for businesses, loan repayment deferrals granted by banks, rent waivers by landlords, the Australian Taxation Office giving firms a breather, and the Australian Government's temporary insolvency moratorium. Some 7,158 companies went bust in the 11 months to May 31 this year, leaving administrator appointments on track to match or exceed pre-pandemic levels recorded between 2017 and 19 financial years. Appointments have hit 2,032 in construction, 1,013 in accommodation food services, 419 in retail, and 423 in manufacturing. Collapsed home builder Porter Davis has been the highest profile casualty, but more businesses outside the troubled construction sector are also appointing administrators or being wound up as debt and equity finances becomes more challenging. These include stripping transport group stocks, refrigerated logistics, rapid delivery service Milk Run, beauty and skincare group BWX, and craft beer company Tribe Brewing. And sentiment among manufacturers has plunged to its lowest level since the global financial crisis, as the industry grapples with rising costs and a slow economy, with some firms predicted to go bust. A net 32% of manufacturers expect the general business situation to worsen over the next 6 months, according to ACCI Westpac Industrial Trends Survey for the June quarter. The figure represented a sharp deterioration from the March quarter, when a net 15% of respondents thought conditions would get worse and was the weakest outcome in 14 years. The release of the survey comes amid mounting evidence that growth in the economy is slowing in response to the fastest interest rate tightening cycle in a generation. While higher interest rates have so far failed to tame inflation or to force a meaningful increase in the unemployment rate, they have contributed to a downturn in discretionary spending and a souring in consumer and business sentiment. And that 10% of manufacturers predict their profits will decline in the coming year, according to the ACCI Westpac survey. And Medibank Private will have to set aside $250 million as insurers against issues associated with a major data breach last year, with the Prudential Regulator also reviewing the company's governance and risk culture. The decision by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority would likely increase the risk of adverse class action rulings against the company, according to equities analyst JP Morgan. The additional capital adequacy requirement, which came as a surprise to some in the market, was a short to medium term negative for the stock itself, and arguably indicates increased risk of adverse findings in the class actions against it related to the cyber breach. The investment bank's Siddharth Paramesiswaran wrote in a note to clients on Tuesday, the company is facing 3 class action lawsuits from customers and shareholders because of the breach. Maurice Blackburn has also filed a complaint to the office of the Australian Information Commissioner, which could force Medibank to compensate affected companies. In October, almost 10 million customer records were stolen from Medibank by criminal hackers, who later released parts of the information after demanding a random payment. The stolen data included sensitive information on 480,000 policy holders, medical conditions and treatment. In late April, the company said it would introduce changes to its systems after being handed a report on the breach conducted by Deloitte. However, the company will not release a report or its recommendation. And the executive chairman of Bega Cheese, which owns Dairy Farm and the Dairy Farmers Big In and Farmers Union milk brands, along with Vegemite, says labour shortages on dairy farms are contributing to rising milk prices for the households. Barry Irvin said there had been a 9% drop in the volume of milk being produced by dairy farmers in Australia in the past 2 years, a reduction of 700 million litres. Fierce competition for the shrinking pool of milk, which all players, including private label brand owners such as supermarket chain Coles, are chasing, is keeping farmgate prices high, along with rising input costs and inflation. This is at a time when global dairy prices for products such as skim milk powder have fallen about 30% in the past 3 to 4 months. But Mr. Irvin said the disconnect between pricing in the two different parts of its business, branded products and bulk dairy commodities, would prompt write-downs of between $180 million and $280 million of Bega Cheese. The company is reviewing some operations at dairy plants at Koroit and Tatura in country Victoria as it assesses the final extent of write-downs across the company. And Latitude's woes could become even costlier after being hit with a $1 million lawsuit by a former mayoral candidate who said the firm's negligence meant his personal details were shared on the dark web. The firm was hit by a cyber attack in March after a hacker used privileged credentials from a third-party vendor to access its systems and steal the data of 7.9 million customers. Sharia Sean Safari was one of the few people affected by the hack and is now pursuing Latitude Financial Services Australia for $1 million in damages in a federal court case filed earlier this month. According to documents filed with the court, Safari held a low-rate Latitude MasterCard credit card. He had his personal information stolen in the data breach and provided to the dark web, where other parties could use it for financial gain. Safari, who was an unsuccessful independent candidate for Maitland's mayoralty in 2021, claims the firm failed to take reasonable steps to protect and secure his data, breaching both his privacy and its duty of care to protect him from harm. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Andrew Kuno, who created Foundation, an Australian-made personal care product that donates 100% of all its profits to registered charities supporting the survivors of domestic violence in Australia. And I'll be talking to RMIT economist Sinclair Davidson about the likelihood of recession. In the meantime, catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business on the Apple Podcast Store or on my website, leongetler.com. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongetler.com. I answer all emails. Wish you all a safe and healthy week, and looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.